This is The Political Scene, a weekly conversation with New Yorker writers and editors about politics. It's Friday, July 29th. I'm Dorothy Wickenden, executive editor of The New Yorker. This week, at their convention in Philadelphia, Democrats talked about family, faith, and patriotism after a Republican convention that invoked the country's fears and divisions. On Wednesday night, President Obama spoke.
12 years ago tonight, I addressed this convention for the very first time. I was filled with faith, faith in America, the generous, big-hearted, hopeful country that made my story, that made all of our stories possible. Now, lots happened over the years. And while this nation has been tested by war, and it's been tested by recession, and all manner of challenges, I stand before you again tonight, after almost two terms as your president, to tell you I am more optimistic about the future of America than ever before.
Trump accepted the Republican nomination last Thursday night.
Our convention occurs at a moment of crisis for our nation. The attacks on our police and the terrorism of our cities threaten our very way of life. I have a message for all of you. The crime and violence that today afflicts our nation will soon, and I mean very soon, come to an end. Beginning on January 20th of 2017, safety will be restored.
John Caste and Jill Lepore, who attended both conventions, are here to discuss almost diametrically opposed appeals to the American voter. John, Obama also, as you pointed out this week, essentially called Trump un-American. That was a pretty effective counterpunch, it seemed, after everything Trump has said about him. But is it going to make any difference?
Well, I certainly hope so. I mean, I think the issue here is both parties are sort of vying for the soul of America. And it's interesting because the sort of idea of what do they mean by America has been a sort of running theme through the two conventions. In some sense, of course, Trump is just running an old-fashioned nationalist America First campaign. But the way that the Democrats, and certainly Obama in particular, are countering that is to give us this idea that actually, you know, they're the anti-patriotic party, and this gives us an opening to portray the Democrats as the soul of the new America, this diverse, this vibrant, this rapidly growing country compared to the rest of the world, which everybody else around the world still sees as the sort of city in the shining hill. I mean, I think it is a clever counter-strategy. The question is, you know, how far does it go? Trump's basically appealing to people's fears and saying, look, the world's going to hell. We need a strong man. I'm the guy. The Democrats' response to that isn't as clear-cut. They say, you know, there are serious issues here, but we're not in overall decline. The question is, how sort of disaffected and how dystopian feeling are the people out there in the country?
It's also striking a Republican note, clearly.
Definitely. I mean, I never remember, maybe I'm mistaken, but I don't remember a convention where you had a whole series of sort of four-star generals up there saying vote Democrat, basically, and saying that the other guy is a threat to the country. The sort of set piece they did last night with all the veterans, basically saying Trump wasn't fit to be commander-in-chief and he was a threat to the Republic, and Hillary was, you know, would make a great president. That really is a play, you know, it's a sort of Republican play from the 70s when the Democrats were always pilloried as soft on defense and sort of closet commies or whatever. So things have flipped, and I think we just have to wait and see how effective that will be.
Jill, you've written a piece for next week's magazine about the radically different visions of the country presented at these conventions, and also as an American historian about what we're seeing right now in the voices of we the people. So can you give us just a little preview about what you're saying in that piece?
In the piece, I do a lot of, I sort of went up to every single person I could and said, you know, how do you imagine the future of the United States? Which is exactly the question a historian doesn't usually ask. You know, how do you project forward in time rather than backward in time? And you know, it was really concerning because across the political spectrum, and you know, Sanders, from Sanders people to Jill Stein people to, you know, not just Trump and Clinton people, there is a shared sense of unease. But that was largely kind of deliberate branding decision, especially on the part of the Democrats, to respond to Trump.
Well, and a pretty obvious branding decision. Yeah. You know, of course, they had to do it.
But it's, you know, it was so corporate, actually, being there and watching the party whips pull out the signs in between speakers. So now is when we wave this sign, and it has a heart on it. The way that was so deliberate, but it's an answer to a similarly apocalyptic vision that liberals have of a Trump presidency. And that, I think, has been a little bit missed.
You talked to one Palestinian-American woman who looked at you as if you were crazy when you asked her whether Clinton or Trump could bridge the various divides in America. And I think she said to you, they are the divide. How did you take that?
Yeah, the people had some awfully clever answers. This woman, she just felt very strongly that it was an impossibly silly question. And I met another, a very young woman, a young African-American woman, who said more or less the same thing. I kept asking people, you know, whoever their candidate was, do you think either candidate can unify a divided nation at this moment? And people really just, even if they liked somebody, they laughed at that. And they said, you know, that's actually not the point of politics. Politics is actually about playing on divisions. And Democrats will say that they're about unifying the American people, but they are drawing those lines. And in a way, what was really heartbreaking, not as a historian per se, but as a citizen being at these conventions, is if there was ever a moment in recent American history when a kind of bonding over civic obligation was required, you know, following on the heels of the shootings, you know, not just from Ferguson forward, but from Newtown, you know, forward, the kind of frayed nature of our kind of American nerve needed some shoring up. And a partisan political convention is exactly not the place where that can happen.
That's a great point.
And you could see Obama trying to do that in his speech, which I think is the one speech, and that's obviously his job in a different way. But this young African-American woman I spoke to, you know, I really love Obama, but if he couldn't do it, if he couldn't be that bridge, who can do that?
Yes. Last night, I thought, actually one of the most remarkable moments at either convention was Khazir Khan, who spoke about losing his son, a Muslim captain in the American Army. And I just want to play that for a second. I want to ask you about it.
If it was up to Donald Trump, he never would have been in America. Donald Trump consistently smears the character of Muslims. He vows to build walls and ban us from this country. Donald Trump, you're asking Americans to trust you with their future. Let me ask you, have you even read the United States Constitution? I will gladly lend you my copy.
So, Jill, that was incredible. But will that call to patriotism make any dent in the Trump voters you spoke to? I've seen some Republicans who found it very moving and thought it was a kind of an incredible moment. You also spoke to a man who said he admires Lincoln and believes that Trump is the only one who can put it together again. So parse this for us.
Yeah, that was a really powerful moment. And it was such a contrast to the analog moment at the Republican convention when the mother whose son had died at Benghazi got up and blamed Hillary Clinton for her son's murder.
Yes.
And talked about confronting Hillary Clinton over her son's coffin. And, you know, it was one of these sort of lock her up moments, guilty, guilty, guilty. The visceral response in the convention hall to those, you know, on the television screen is just so powerfully different. And the white-black nature of these two visions and these two moods butted up against one another. You know, one party braced for combat and the other insisting on love. Because a piece of that was most striking last night, of course, was the softening of Hillary Clinton.
Yes.
That she has to be, she weirdly, at this moment of taking this leap into a position of tremendous authority, was never more softened, more scrubbed up, more purified, more feminized than in that lead up to her nomination acceptance speech. And part of that was necessary as the crescendo of the story of love, you know, that this is a party of love. I don't know. It just didn't sit well. I mean, I realize it's an attempt to be opposite land to the yes. Republican convention. But I think in the long run, that is a very treacherous political maneuver.
Let's listen to her just for a second so we can hear how she tried to get at some of these themes, not love per se, but to really address the people who are suffering.
If you believe that companies should share profits, not pad executive bonuses, join us. If you believe the minimum wage should be a living wage and no one working full time should have to raise their children in poverty, join us. If you believe that every man, woman, and child in America has the right to affordable health care, join us.
So what about that, Jill? Are people going to hear that, the people she needs to hear that, which include both the Bernie bros and the disaffected Republicans?
It was a very substantial policy speech, unsurprisingly. I think it was a little bit actually hard to get that message across, given the elaborate kind of pink-ribboned package that it came in. And that's the piece of that I found surprising, to go that far in that direction of packaging Clinton as a loving grandmother and stepping away from her authority as an expert in foreign policy, her governmental experience. So I don't know. I don't know that people can receive that in that package.
John, you gave us a great analysis as of 3:40 this morning discussing Clinton's domestic policy and whether she will emphasize building on the progress that Obama has made or rewriting the rules, which is far more appealing, of course, to the populist Sanders wing. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, it turns out there's been quite a lot of debate inside the Clinton campaign and in the sort of think tanks around the campaign about not only what policies to adopt. They've actually adopted quite a lot of Sanders policies recently, of course, on trade and minimum wage, etc., but on how to present them to the public. And the two frames you mentioned are the two that they've sort of been vacillating about. Do you emphasize how much progress has been made, which is what President Obama did the other night when he was giving his litany of success, which is, you know, obviously understandable. He's defending his own record. Or do you take a darker view and try and sort of meet Trump a bit on his own ground and say things aren't working, you're right, the economy isn't delivering wage increases, the bosses are keeping your wages down, Wall Street is screwing the rest of the economy, that sort of line, which doesn't come naturally to Clinton, of course. But I think she has edged in that direction. If you listen to the speech last night, certainly wasn't Sanders-esque language, but it was. There was a lot of progressive stuff in there. She did say that you're right to be furious, the American public, the economy isn't working properly. She did say that businesses who shift jobs abroad and then give people pink slips, that's the wrong thing to do. So she was, at least tipping her hat to the Sanders wing. And then, of course, she rolled out all the list of policies she's got, which, as I say, is quite a progressive list now, if you include everything in the party platform as well as what she said.
But she's so deeply tied to Wall Street, and it's one of the reasons people so mistrust her. Can she make the case? And now she'll have, we assume, Sanders is going to be out there on the campaign trail doing his best to rally everyone around her. Can she make the case convincingly that she's going to take on the 1%ers, corporate tax breaks, all of that?
Well, it's a 1%er taking on, the 1%, of course, given how much the money the Clintons earned over the last 15 years. But that is obviously the big question of the campaign. Is she a credible messenger for the message she's now delivering? And I think a lot of the convention here, which I think, as Dilla said, was very slickly produced and very efficient at getting across the message they wanted, was designed to make her seem like more of a sort of defender of the common people. A lot of emphasis on her work defending children's rights and sort of making things better for families. Feeling in the campaign, I think, is that where, that's where she's really credible. She's got a history working for the Children's Defence Fund. She's got a history working on legislation to improve the lives of children. People can believe her on those issues, and that gives her a sort of entry into all the other issues. Whether that works, of course, is the big issue. I don't have an answer for that. That's the big question of the campaign.
I think that's exactly right, but I think all those advantages of her positioning herself as a defender of children cut another way, right? I mean, it's just to emphasize that she is a female candidate. It's to run as a softer version of Obama. It's to counter the aggression and sort of muscularity of Trump. And with the branch of vote, with the group of voters that she most needs, that doesn't actually gain their confidence, right? It exposes her vulnerability.
Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit NewYorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
And, Jill, one other thing I want to cite from your piece, which is absolutely right, and I think is a big problem, which is the mistakes that the Clintons and other progressives have made for decades, which is ignoring the right-wing narrative of decline, which has been there all along, and on the left, Sanders' narrative, and he's been there all along, about the gaping divide between rich and poor, which has been getting worse and worse. So is it too late for Clinton to change the story?
I think it's too late to see Hillary Clinton as sort of a class warrior taking on the 1%. I don't think that the campaign thinks they can completely change people's perceptions of Hillary Clinton in a couple of months. I think what they are trying to do is to sort of elide some of her history and then present her as somebody who has shifted ground but is now genuinely in the center of the Democratic Party and will be sort of campaigning on lunch pail issues and delivering a moderately progressive agenda if she's elected. I think they think that they can push things that far.
To my mind, Joe Biden gave perhaps, one of the best speeches of all, his comment about Trump, "You're fired." That whole little set piece, I thought, hit the nose right on the head for some of those working class voters whom the party desperately needs.
Yeah, well, I think that's it. I mean, how much do you have to build Clinton up? I mean, the issue, both parties are basically running on the keep the other guy out of office strategy. The Republican convention was, apart from Trump's sort of I'm the Fuhrer speech, was mainly about, keep Hillary out. Speaker after speaker stood up and said, this is all about keeping Hillary Clinton out of the Oval Office. And the same thing at the DNC, apart from the sort of orchestrated effort to recast Hillary's image, the main theme of the week was, we saw in Obama's speech, keep Donald Trump out of the office. And if your main strategy is basically taking the other guy down, you don't have to necessarily build your candidate up. They just have to sort of pass a certain credibility test. So I think that's what this was all about. Jill makes a very good point, though, in that there is a certain cognitive dissonance in what the Democrats have been trying to say about Hillary. So, which is it? Is she the sort of soft and cuddly grandmother, or is she sort of the Iron Lady who's going to mash the terrorists?
Well, and this has plagued her entire career. The idea of her as possibly the first female in the White House, how much does that strike terror in the hearts of the Trump supporters?
It has to be a piece of the just deep physical detestation of her on the part of a lot of people that you talk to. I mean, they wince, they shudder, they and, it's a little bit more than she's a Wall Street crony, I find her unethical. It's a it's a kind of hatred that feels some piece of that has to do with her being a woman and it being unacceptable. I don't know how that's going to play.
I mean, there is some polling data suggesting that the gender actually works for her. You know, among college-educated women, for example, Hillary is now running 20 points ahead of what Obama did relative to Obama over Romney in 2012. And for the first time, they think that they'll also got a good chance of winning. Democrats think they've got a good chance of winning white working-class women as well. So, you know, she is appealing to women, certainly women over a certain age. And obviously, she turns off some men. There's some misogyny out there. But the polling data so far does seem to suggest that maybe it could be a net plus for her.
Thank you both so much. John Cassidy is a staff writer and the author most recently of How Markets Fail, The Logic of Economic Calamities. Jill Lepore is a staff writer and a professor of American history at Harvard. One of her recent books is Book of Ages, The Life and Opinions of Jane Franklin. This has been The Political Scene from The New Yorker. You can find more political analysis and commentary on NewYorker.com or on the New Yorker app from the App Store and Google Play. And you can subscribe to this and other New Yorker podcasts by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app. The Political Scene is produced by Alex Barron and Jill Duboff for NewYorker.com. I'm Dorothy Wickenden.